You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide, Collected Works, Volume 202, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 5th of December, 1920. It will have become apparent to you yesterday that we see the world in a one-sided way when we consider it in the manner expressed with special clarity in Hegel, as if it were pervaded by what we can call cosmic thought. It is equally one-sided to see the fabric of the world as will-like in nature. This, of course, is the view of Schopenhauer, who thinks of the world in terms of will. We have seen that the particular tendency to regard the world as an outcome of thought has an affinity with Western human nature, which tends to accentuate the aspect of thought. We showed, though, that Hegel's philosophy of thought assumes a different form in Western views of the world, and that Schopenhauer's sensibility reveals the tendency, intrinsic really, in Oriental people. This becomes apparent in the fact that Schopenhauer is especially drawn to Buddhism and to the Oriental worldview in general. This way of regarding things can only really be properly evaluated if we survey it from the point of view available to us in the science of the spirit. From this perspective, however, summing the world up in terms of thought or of will appears somewhat abstract. As we have often stated, the recent era of human evolution has increasingly tended to favor such abstractions. The science of the spirit must return us again to a tangible grasp of the world, one that accords with reality. In fact, a grasp of the world that does accord with reality will reveal the very reasons why such one-sided views arise. Hegel and Schopenhauer, who are, after all, great, important, and brilliant minds, certainly see things that exist in the world. They just have to be seen in the right way. Today, let us first be clear that as human beings, we experience thought within us. When a person speaks of his experience of thought, this is a direct experience for him. Naturally, he could not have this experience of thought if the world were not pervaded by thought. How indeed could we draw thought from our sensory perceptions of the world if this thought were not implicit in the world? But as we know from previous studies, the human head organism is constructed in a way that endows it with a special capacity to draw in thoughts from the world. It is formed by thought, created from thought. But at the same time, the human head organism points us back to a previous life on earth. We know that the human head is really the metamorphosed outcome of previous lives on earth, whereas the human limb system points us forward to future lives. To put it bluntly, we have a head because the limbs in our past life have metamorphosed into it. Our present limbs, with all that belongs to them, will again metamorphose into the head we will carry on our shoulders in our next life on earth. Currently, in our life between birth and death, thoughts are at work in our head primarily. These thoughts, as we have seen, are at the same time the transformation or metamorphosis of what worked as will in our limbs in our previous life. And what works as will in our present limbs will again be transformed into thoughts in our subsequent life on earth. Thought is therefore something which continually arises in humanity's evolution as a metamorphosis of the will. And the will appears to us in a sense as seed of the thought. Thus the will gradually develops into the thought. See Plate 5, upper oblique line. What is first will later become thought. In considering our nature as human beings, we find that the part of us which is head hails from a previous time in which it possessed will character. As we look to the future, we must ascribe our present will character to our limbs, seeing that this will eventually become what develops in us as head, our thought organism. See plate 5, lower oblique line. But we continually bear both these within us. In a sense, you can say that we arise from the universe by virtue of the fact that in us thought from prior times combines in a coherent organism with the will that seeks a forward future trajectory. Spiritual scientific research can show us in an especially vivid and tangible way what organizes us through the confluence of thought and will, permeates and organizes us in a way which comes to expression in our outward organism. Someone who can develop to the point of acquiring insights through imagination, inspiration, and intuition will see not just the externally visible head, but will gain objective perception of the thought organism mediated by it. You can say that he looks upon thoughts themselves, and there's a drawing circle in thoughts. In other words, the faculties inherent in us as a matter of course between birth and death show us the head in the configuration in which it exists as such, whereas insights we can develop through imagination, inspiration, and intuition also render visible, to use this word metaphorically, the thought dynamic underlying the head organism, which has developed from former incarnations. In what way does this become visible? The only way to describe it is by saying that this soul spiritual and, of course, not physical visibility becomes luminous. See plate 5, the crown of light. When those contentedly rooted in a materialistic outlook criticize such things as this, we can immediately see how people today lack the sensitivity to grasp what is meant by them. In my book titled Theosophy, and in other writings, I have plainly stated that I am not suggesting the appearance of a new physical world, a new, in quotes, edition of the physical world. When I speak of perceiving the human thought organism through imagination, inspiration, and intuition. Yet the experience one has here is certainly the same as that of light in the external physical world. To be precise about this, one would have to say that we have a certain experience in perceiving external light, and that we can then have the same experience as this when we perceive the head's element of thought through the faculty of imagination. See plate 5. Thus perceived objectively, the element of thought is seen as light, or rather experienced as light. As thinking human beings, we live in light. We see external light with our physical senses, but do not see in this way the light that becomes thought, since we ourselves are this light, living within it as thought organism. We cannot initially see something that we ourselves are. Only when we step out of or beyond our thoughts by entering into imagination, inspiration, and intuition do we see them as such, and then perceive the thought element as light. A full picture of the world would show us this. We possess light within us, but it does not appear to us as light there, since we are living within it. And because in employing this light, possessing it, it becomes thought in us. We take possession of the light in a sense. The light that you otherwise perceive externally, you also incorporate into you, differentiating it and working within it. This is your thinking faculty. Activity within light. You are a being of light, but do not know it, because you live in that element. Nevertheless, the thinking you develop is a life within light, which you can certainly perceive once you regard it from without. See Plate 4. Now consider the universe, the left-hand drawing. During the day, you see it pervaded by light. But now imagine that you observe this universe from outside. And now things are reversed. A moment ago, we saw how the human head, whose interior contains developing thought, perceives light outside itself. In the universe, we have light which we perceive with our senses. If we emerge from the universe and observe it from without, how does it appear? As a fabric of thoughts. The universe is inwardly light, and observed from without, thought. The human head is inwardly thought, and seen from without, light. This way of regarding the cosmos can be immensely useful and helpful if you will really take it on board, really engage with it. Your thinking, your whole life of soul, will acquire much greater mobility than it otherwise has if you learn to imagine this. If I emerged from myself, as is continually the case whenever I fall asleep, and looked back upon my head, or in other words, upon my life of thoughts, I would perceive myself as luminous. If I emerged from the world, from the sun-illumined world, and observed it from without, I would perceive it as a being of thoughts. So you can see that light and thought belong together. They are in fact the same thing, just seen from different perspectives. The thought living in us, originating really in a previous era, is the most mature aspect of us, the outcome of former lives. What once was will has become thought and appears as light. And this can give you the sense that where there is light, there is also thought. But of what kind? It is thought in which a world is continually dying and fading. A previous world, the world of a past era, dies within thought. Or to put it another way, within light. This is one of the secrets of the universe. We look out into the universe, which is pervaded by light. In light lives thought. But in this thought-permeated light lives a dying world. The world is continually dying in light. Someone like Hegel really observed the world's continual dying. The thought element comes to the fore particularly in people who have a special affinity with everything in the world that declines, loses strength, and fades away. And as it does so, the world grows beautiful. The ancient Greeks, who possessed and were pervaded by a very great inner vitality, delighted in the beauty shining forth in the dying away of the world. The light in which the world dies away shines forth its beauty. The world does not grow beautiful if it cannot die. And as it dies, it grows luminous. Thus it is beauty that appears in the luminous glory of a world continually dying. And this is how to acquire a qualitative feeling for the universe. With Galileo and other natural scientists, at the dawn of our modern age, people began to observe the world in quantitative terms. Today, people are particularly proud of their ability to grasp natural phenomena through mathematics. You can see this everywhere in science. And thus apply dead concepts in nature. Hegel, though, used more vivid concepts to grasp the world than merely mathematical ones. And yet he was particularly drawn to what has become mature and begins to die. You could say that Hegel regarded the world like someone who looks at a tree in burgeoning blossom. At the moment when fruits are starting to form, yet are not quite visible yet, when the blossoms are at their peak, the potency of light, and thus light-born thought, is at work in the tree. Thus Hegel stood before all the world's phenomena. He was observing its utmost flowering, all that has found its most tangible form. Schopenhauer saw the world differently. To examine his impetus, we have to consider the other aspect in us, all that is newly initiated. This is the will element we bear in our limbs. Really, we experience this, as I have often said, as we experience the world during sleep. The will element is something we experience unconsciously. Is there any way of observing this will element from without, as we can do with thought? If we consider the will activated in a human limb, what experience would parallel our perception of thought as light, if we were to observe the will from without, from the perspective of imagination, inspiration, and intuition? How do we perceive the will when observing it with a developed faculty of clairvoyant perception? When we can do this, something does indeed become externally visible. Plate 5. To the clairvoyant gaze, thought is experienced as light, as luminosity, whereas will becomes ever denser and becomes substance. If Schopenhauer had been clairvoyant, this being of will would have stood before him as a matter machine, for matter or substance is the external aspect of will. Inwardly, substance is will, in the same way that light is thought. And outwardly, will is substance, in the same way that thought is outwardly light. It is for this reason that I have said the following in the past: those who plunge down mystically into their will nature, but in reality seek only well-being, who practice only a kind of mystical mimicry and actually cultivate the crassest egotism, believe that by this navel gazing they will find the spirit. Yet if they pursued this navel gazing far enough, they would discover the truly material nature of the human interior, for all they are doing is plunging into matter. By plunging into will nature, we encounter the true nature of substance. Scientists are engaged in fantasy when they say that substance consists of molecules and atoms. We discover the true nature of substance when we plunge into it mystically. We find the other aspect of the will and encounter what is really a continually incipient, germinating world. Looking out into the world, you are surrounded by light in which a previous world is dying. You walk upon hard material substance. The strength of the world sustains you. In light, beauty shines as thought. In the glory of this beauty, an old world dies away. The world dawns in its strength and vigor, in its potency, but also in its darkness. In darkness, the world of the future dawns in the will element of substance. When physicists at last see sense, they will no longer speculate about the world consisting of atoms and molecules, but will say, plate 5, the external world consists of the past, and is inwardly sustained, not by atoms and molecules, but by the future. They will speak truly when they come to see that the past appears in radiance in the present, and everywhere envelops the future. The present is always only what past and future together engender. The future is what is really intrinsic to the vigor of substance. The past is what gleams forth in the beauty of light, though naturally light also signifies here everything that manifests, including tone and warmth. And thus the human being can only understand himself when he sees himself as a kernel of the future, enveloped by what originates from the past, by the shining aura of thought. Plate 5, orange. In spiritual terms, our past aspect gleams in an aura of beauty. But integrated into this aura of the past, these rays shining from a former time, is infused a darkness that carries us on into the future. Plate 5, blue. The light is what shines out of the past, whereas the darkness is what points us into the future. The nature of the light is thought, and that of darkness is will. Hegel was drawn to the light unfolding in the process of growth, the utmost blossoming. Schopenhauer observes the world as someone who stands before a tree and takes no pleasure really in the gorgeous, luxuriating blossoms, but who feels an inward prompting to wait until incipient, swelling fruit begin to emerge everywhere from the fading blossoms. He takes pleasure in the growth energy expressed there. This spurs him on. His mouth waters when he thinks of the peach emerging from peach blossom. He turns away from the nature of light to what seizes hold of him inwardly and emerges from the light affinity of the blossom as something developing onward into the future, as fruit whose substance can melt on his tongue. Here we find the world's dual nature, and only regard the world in the right way in these terms, discovering its tangible reality as opposed to a merely abstract schema. When you go out into the world and look at blossoming trees, you are really living from the past. You observe the springtime nature of the world and can discover that what gods have woven into this world in the past now becomes apparent in spring's profusion of blossoms. And you observe the fruiting world of autumn and discover there a new deed of the gods commencing. What is capable of further development falls from the tree and can evolve into the future. It is important that we do not form a view of the world drawn only from speculation, but that we engage fully and inwardly with it. In plum blossom, for instance, we can gain a tangible hold of the past and intuit the real nature of the future in the plum itself. What shines upon our eyes as an inner connection with what we have evolved into from the past. What melts upon our tongue as taste has an inner connection with a realm from which we arise anew, like the phoenix from its ash, as we enter the future. Here we grasp the world in sensation and feeling. This feeling grasp of the world is what Goethe sought, really, in all his efforts, to engage with the world in feelings and perceptions. He did this, for example, when observing the green plant world. Without having at his disposal the science of the spirit available to us today, he observed the green world of vegetation before flowers fully appear, and saw in it a past coming to expression in the present nature of the plant. While it is true that the past appears in a plant's flowering, a more recent past already comes to expression in the green leaf. The green vegetation is, in a sense, something that has not yet died away so much, has not yet fully succumbed to the past, plate 5 green. But what points into the future emerges out of darkness. Wherever green shades into blue, we discover what appears in nature as its future element, blue, plate 5. By contrast, we are directed back to the past, wherever the blossoming impulse of warmth emerges, red, and where light not only brightens, but is inwardly permeated with strength and passes into warmth. We would really have to draw the whole thing like this. And there's a drawing. Here is the green of plant vegetation. Goethe would experience this even without having transposed it into spiritual or esoteric science, and it connects with darkness, where the green shades into bluer tones. By contrast, the brightening, warmth-imbued element would connect to the upper aspect in the drawing. But as human beings, we have inwardly what comes to outer expression in the green world of vegetation. Inwardly, the human etheric body, as I have often said, is peach blossom colored. And that is also the color that appears when blue infuses red. That is what we ourselves are. And therefore, in gazing out into the world, we can say that we ourselves stand within peach blossom nature, confronting an outer world of green. We find this as objective reality in the world of plants. On the one hand, we have bluish darkness, and on the other, bright reddish yellow. But because we ourselves stand within the peach blossom element, live in it. We cannot immediately perceive this. Can do so, in fact, as little as we can perceive thought as light. What we ourselves experience, we do not perceive. Therefore we overlook the peach blossom aspect, and gaze only upon the red we extend in one direction, and upon the blue we extend in the other, so that a rainbow spectrum appears before us. This is, however, only an illusion. We would obtain the true spectrum only by curving this bow of color into a circle. Instead, because we ourselves stand in the peach blossom element, we bend it straight and therefore survey only the color world, passing from blue to red and from red to blue through green. The moment one also perceived this aspect, every rainbow would become a circle, a cylinder with a circular cross-section. I have mentioned this only to show you that Goethe's view of nature is certainly at the same time a view of the spirit, and accords fully with spiritual perception. If we consider Goethe the scientist, it is clear that while he does not yet have access to a science of the spirit, he has nevertheless developed a natural science which wholly accords with it. The essential thing in today's observations, though, is to see the world, including the human being, as a mutual permeation of thought light, light thoughts, with will substance, substance will. And what we encounter as essence and structure in all kinds of tangible ways is composed of both thought light, light thought, and substance will substance. To observe the cosmos in the right way, it is important to perceive it qualitatively and not just quantitatively. When we do so, we find that this cosmos encompasses a continual dying away, a dying of past times in light, and a dawning of the future in darkness. With an instinctive clairvoyance, the ancient Persians called Ahura Mazda what they experienced as a dying past in the light, and Ahriman, in quotes, what they experienced as future in the darkness of the will. These two world entities, light and darkness, give us the living thought and the dying past in light, and the emerging will and coming future in darkness. If we can succeed in seeing thought not as something abstract, but as light, and will again not as something abstract, but as darkness, and even perceive its material nature, and if we can succeed in seeing the warmth side of the light spectrum as identical with the past, and the substance side, the chemical side of the spectrum, as identical with future, we start perceiving tangible realities rather than living in abstractions. Doing so, we will no longer be thinkers of a merely arid or pedantic kind who use our heads alone, for we will know that what thinks inside our heads is actually the same as what streams around us as light. Nor will we remain stuck in preconceptions that tell us light is merely something to delight in, for we will know that light bears death within it, a dying world. In light we can also experience a universal tragedy. In such ways we depart from abstract thought and enter a flowing, fluctuating world. We see a dawning future in darkness, even finding here what spurs on passionate souls, such as Schopenhauer. In brief, we depart from the abstract and enter into all that is specific and tangible. Instead of mere thoughts or abstract impulses of will, whole cosmic configurations arise before our gaze. Next time we will seek in the remarkably tangible insights we elaborated today of thought being light and will being darkness, for the origins of good and evil. Thus we will advance from an inner world into the cosmos, seeking there once again not just abstract foundations for good and evil as religion often presents them, but trying to break through to a real knowledge of good and evil. The basis for this inquiry was laid today by grasping thought in its light and will in its growing dark. Next time, we will continue in this vein. The end of Lecture 5.